The final edition Radio Hour is a work of satire intended for audiences who own books, gentrify neighborhoods, and say they like kale. Please consume responsibly, the satire, that is.
Hi, I'm Jeff Chrysler.
And I'm Tony Hendra, a.k.a. Satirius Hendra.
And this is the final edition Radio Hour, Satire with Teeth.
Appropriately enough, this week we have a religiously tinged show for you.
But first, some of the news stories we've decided not to touch with a 10-cubit long pole. We haven't found a way to satirize Mike Huckabee's claim that there's more freedom in North Korea than in the United States, since it's certainly true for some people, like a wrongfully arrested Muslim who's been rotting in Gitmo for 13 years.
We have nothing to say about Chelsea Clinton's baby and future hereditary president of the United States.
And while many people have fond memories of the 1964 New York World's Fair, which happened 50 years ago this week, Tony Hendra does not.
My partner Nick Ullett and I appeared at the New York World's Fair doing our twittering Brit satire and bombed big time. Our audience consisted of 11 completely baffled Pakistanis. We were a two-man Hiroshima. The 1964 New York World's Fair sucked.
But we do reveal how Paul Ryan's going to keep us healthy once he gets rid of Obamacare and Medicare.
We have a moving eulogy for America's oldest teenager now that Archie Comics is euthanizing him.
And this being Holy Week, we have a revelation about the now authenticated ancient papyrus that mentioned Jesus' wife that will rock all three Abrahamic faiths.
So fasten your seatbelts in that GM or Toyota car, and away we go. This is the Final Edition Radio Hour. And now, over to Texas for the latest on the historic governor's race between Greg Abbott and Wendy Davis.
Mr. Abbott, do you agree with your most prominent supporter, Ted Nugent, that President Obama is a subhuman mongrel?
Know something? I reckon you media buzzards keep asking me that because you like saying Obama is a subhuman mongrel.
Greg, do you think Obama is a subhuman mongrel?
Yes and no. We know he's a mongrel, but hey, we're all mutts in America.
But do you think he's subhuman?
I did not say that. Ted Nugent said that. I'm running for senator of this great state in this election to fight for the right of any man and some women to his own opinion and some of hers.
But you welcome the support of someone who thinks Obama is a subhuman mongrel. Doesn't that at least...
You're doing it again. You like saying that.
Know what? You're right. How do we feel about saying Obama's a subhuman mongrel? I'll tell you how. Good. That's how good. Got any openings in the campaign, Greg?
Sure do. Let me put this to bed. When it comes to subhuman mongrels, it takes one to know one. Now, Ted's a mongrel, like we all are, but I don't know if he's subhuman. So he could be right about Obama being a subhuman mongrel, or he could be wrong about Obama being a subhuman mongrel.
Okay, but are you going to distance yourself from Mr. Nugent in any way?
Yep. I'm issuing an order that next time we appear together, like right here tonight, there is at least one microphone between him and me.
Welcome to the Final Edition Radio Hour's finance feature, Money or Die. It's time once again to find out who's coming out on top in the epic annual battle of wits and withholding between the big bad IRS and plucky little us.
And we're back. I'm Bill Flem, and this is Deduction 2014, the final edition's income tax coverage. With me, as always, is co-host and tax specialist, Blood Moon Eclipse. I wanted to list my friendship with you as a business expense.
And I'm the one who told you you'd be thrown in jail if you did.
I love tax humor.
Well, let's put that on the long form for now, because the early returns are coming in.
We don't want to give any spoilers, because the post offices are still open on the West Coast.
However, here at the final edition, we are projecting the bigger winner on Income Tax Day is the 1%.
They seem to run away with it every year.
And who came in second? The 99%?
No, they're in third. The middle class tax cheats came in second.
What's next for the 1%, Bill?
I don't know. They're very patriotic. I imagine they'll be celebrating all over the country.
And that country is the Cayman Islands.
Yes, the 1% are our finest Cayman beings.
To wrap up, Tax Day once more goes to the 1%.
Whoops, we're just getting this news. The upper 0.5% have actually beaten the lower 0.5% on this Tax Day.
Oh, that's gotta hurt.
I hurt just thinking about it.
This is Blood Moon Eclipse.
And I'm Bill Flem for the final edition.
And now, the final edition Radio Hour takes you to Riverdale, where the country's oldest teenager is about to receive some news.
Hey, gang!
Hey, Archie!
Why so sad, guys? Jughead, your jaunty but out-of-date crown hat is wilting.
Sorry, Arch. We're going to a funeral.
That's why the jalopy is painted black. It's a hearse-loppy.
Oh, I thought it was because you couldn't afford blue paint. Hey, I told an unfunny joke, and nobody's laughing.
Sorry, Archie.
Sorry about what, Veronica?
I'm Betty. I'm Veronica.
You sound like you're the exact same person.
We are.
Come on, Arch. We can't be late, or the gravediggers get overtime. While the dead guy gets afterlife. And his relatives get his underwear.
Are you finished?
No, but you are.
Come on, guys. I'm not going any... Hey, what are you doing?
Taking you to the funeral home.
We're pallbearers.
That's great, guys, but there's only one problem.
What's that?
My name's not Paul.
Oh, honey, honey, you are my candy girl, and you got me wanting.
House Budget Committee Chairman Paul Ryan has presented the American people with a new budget. It does away with Obamacare, projects that Medicare's trust fund will go bankrupt, and promises, quote, real reform, unquote, of Medicare for, quote, future generations, unquote. Our Strong Powers and Pepper Lewis caught up with the congressman in the House gym.
Congressman, what is your rationale for doing away with Obamacare?
And what is your dramatic new proposal for reforming Medicare?
Strong and Pepper, as a devout Catholic, I believe that our health comes from God. And that health has to be earned.
How do you earn health?
Clean living and good works.
And that will keep ailing Americans alive?
For 200 years, Americans of all denominations survived on reliable, sometimes miraculous, cures based on fervent prayer. If they hadn't, there'd be no United States. As good conservatives, we need to get back to that simple trust. I intend to replace Obamacare and Medicare with a faith-based system of healing called MetaPrayer.
You expect miracles to work in the 21st century?
How has the church survived 2,000 years? Why are the Southern Baptists bigger than ever?
Because they eat at Chick-fil-A?
We'll bring faith-based healing into the 21st century. every metaprayer will include the exact nature of a patient's medical condition so God's attention can be focused with laser-like precision on a cure.
Can you give us an example?
Right here on Skype, meet Dr. Phil Faustus, Professor Emeritus of Faith-Based Oncology at Bob Jones University. Dr. Faustus, heal thy patient.
O Lord, shower thy faithful patient Tabitha McGee, age 64 of Tallahassee, diagnosed with inoperable stage 4 esophageal cancer, in the supremo chemo of thy mercy. Shrink to nothing the 2.4 centimeter malignant tumor in the C3 vector of her squamous tissue with the blazing light of thy divine radiation. Amen.
I'm cured. Praise Jesus. That old demon's flying right out of my windpipe.
See, according to accredited, non-indicted GOP medical consultants, MetaPrayer cure rates will kill those now claimed by wasteful Medicare providers. And at a fraction of the cost. Except for Tabitha's copay.
Put the bills in the bucket, honey.
So MetaPrayer comes up with miraculous cures. What about prevention?
Holy pictures, pilgrimages to Lourdes. Above all, those lovely images of the Virgin that appear in cornflakes, rust stains, used diapers.
Jesus, you're replacing effective health care by exploiting the desperation of the poor and aged.
Hey, I prayed to an image of the Virgin just yesterday in the second quarter receivables liabilities curve of Koch Industries, and my reflex problem cleared up like that.
Wow, really? You know, I get terrible reflux.
That's no miracle. You're an extremely wealthy young man who can afford to stay in shape.
You know why I glow with health, Pepper? Because my heart is pure. Speaking of Jesus, MetaPrayer draws its power from his awesome miracles.
Jesus didn't charge for curing the sick.
We don't know that. When Christ returns, I'm sure he'll charge competitive fees for miraculous services.
You gotta admit, Pepper, miraculous health care, especially with Jesus 2.0, will make great television.
Ugh, I give up. Men are morons.
My fellow Americans, we are a Christian nation. And faithful Christians don't really need that much medical care. This life is just preparation for the next. That's why God wants you to repeal Obamacare and get on the fast track to heaven now.
Stay tuned for more of the Final Edition Radio Hour when we reveal how Jesus thought of his wife, what elections will look like in 10 years' time, and Mrs. Betty Bauer's very inspirational Christian bedtime stories. All coming up after this.
Welcome back to the Final Edition Radio Hour, Satire with Teeth.
The following portion of the Final Edition Radio Hour is brought to you by Independence.
You're an active junior senior. You hike, you bike, you ski, you paraglide. But you have a seriously loose bowel, and you hate being dependent on others. Consider switching from your current rear-end insurance to Independence. Independence is the super-absorbent super pad that allows you to be all you yourself can be. No more bossy nurses, fussy caregivers, or disgusted friends and family. Yes, with Independs, you yourself can change yourself.
Hi there, old timer. Looks like you're experiencing an involuntary colonic event. Want a little semi-professional TLC to help you minimize the unbearable shame of public incontinence?
No thanks, little lady. I'll TCB all by my ownsome, thanks a bunch. With just a flick of these two trusty tabs, I myself can change myself. I step out of my slightly soiled old pair of Independs.
Oh my God, what's he doing?
And into my clean, pristine, sweet-smelling new pair of Independs. Dispose of that, will you, honey?
Are you kidding?
Independs come in several fetching styles, like Tommy Bahama's Senior Megathong and Billabong's Bondi Beach Triple XL Surfer Briefs. For your fun, active, junior-senior lifestyle, enjoy the peace of mind that passeth all misunderstanding. With Independs, every day is Independs Day.
An ancient Coptic papyrus, now at Harvard, which has been authenticated as from the 7th century and has Jesus referring to my wife, has raised a firestorm among the 1.5 billion earthlings who are celebrating Easter this week. Thanks to a source at the Harvard Divinity School, Professor Karen Sharon Person, who has recently resigned her post, the Final Edition Radio Hour has a fascinating videotape of Professor Person and her chief paleographer deciphering the text for the very first time.
So, after the word Jesus, we have wife with a possessive serif indicating my. What's next?
My wife is repeated. Then, hard to decipher. Looks like the word for big with child. But in the more demonic control text, it also means fat. This glyph indicates very or so.
In other words, my wife is very pregnant? Wow, that would mean Jesus had a child. This could be huge.
It could also mean so fat.
Wife, so fat? What could that mean in biblical terms? The fatted calf, fat of the land, the earth being symbolically Jesus' wife?
Let's see. The next word means relaxes or sits around. That's qualified by when and yeah. Then house. Then that same phrase repeats, but with a sign for emphasis, as in really relaxes or sits around.
Okay, my wife repeated, so big with child.
Try fat.
My wife repeated, so fat, when relaxes.
Try sits.
When sits the house. Sits the house, really? How on earth does this fit with gospel traditions, even the non-canonical gospels?
It could be Jesus says, my wife is so fat, when she sits around the house, she really sits around the house.
Are you serious? That sounds like I hardly know how to say the word. A joke.
Later in the text, there's several more mentions of my wife. Here's the word seize or take from my wife. Then I pray or beg. Take from me my wife, I pray or beg.
Take my wife, please?
Exactly. And up here. I seize, no. Take my wife everywhere. Everywhere. I take my wife everywhere, but she always finds her way back. Or, here, I love same woman, no. I have been in love with the same woman 40 years. If my wife finds out, she will kill me. That's funny. Pretty much my life story.
Are you saying this is evidence Jesus was some kind of schlock comedian? This is Harvard, the ancient text division of paleography department.
I've always argued that stand-up comedy owed a great deal to ancient rabbinical tradition.
Are you thinking what I'm thinking?
Jesus was a married comedian? Eat your heart out, Dan Brown.
At least a book-movie series deal.
I can see the title now. Just Jesus! Exclamation point.
Jesus!
Woohoo!
My brother's an agent at CAA.
Welcome back to Election Night 2024, where the results in the presidential race are still very much in doubt. It's now well past midnight on the East Coast, yet election officials are still frantically counting the money.
It's a complicated process, Bob. Even though they've simplified it a little bit by throwing out the votes and just giving the job to whoever raises the most money, it's still an electoral college system, and campaign contributions are winner-take-all within each state.
That's right, Terry. And as of right now, the campaign contributions are evenly split between the labor union candidate, Joey Ramone III, and the Sheldon Adelson candidate, who is... Who the hell is the Republican candidate again?
Well, of course, this is part of the political dynasty of his father, Rand Paul, and his grandfather, Ron Paul. We're talking, of course, about Paul Paul.
Right. Well, it looks like it's really going to come down to the last dime in this race.
But there are a number of races around the country we can start calling. The new senator from Kansas is the Frito-Lay candidate, Mark Slingo, who soundly defeated the Skechers candidate, Larry Binghamton.
And the newest congresswoman from the great state of Iowa is Lisa Banfield, a wholly owned subsidiary of Raytheon. So congratulations to their shareholders.
Can I just say, this has been such an amazing presidential race. Last year at this time, we had no idea which Sheldon Adelson candidate would get the Republican nomination.
And on the Democratic side, we assumed the candidate would be Monsanto or Warner Brothers.
But let's not get bogged down in technicalities. We're going to chat with someone who really represents what this election is all about. A fundraiser.
That's right. This is Ronnie Splenda, a Democratic Party fundraiser and a lobbyist for the Disney Corporation. Ronnie, this must be an exciting night for you.
What? Who are you? Why are you talking? Am I talking? Do you have any money?
It's okay, Ronnie. The election is almost over. You can relax.
Relax? Are you high? We've got to start fundraising for 2040.
Yeah, but Ronnie, that's in 16 years.
My job doesn't stop. Do you understand? If I close my eyes, somebody, somewhere will give money to someone else.
Great. Well, good luck to you.
Oh, you found coffee. Where is that?
All the coffee is mine.
If I can break in, Bob, we have a report that Sheldon Adelson has gathered another $200 million in loose change from his couch. So Paul Paul now surges ahead.
And now, we're honored and humbled to have with us America's best Christian, Mrs. Betty Bowers.
Whether it's reading factual Bible stories or giving secular fairy tales new Bible-ish endings, in our Christian home, my children never nod off at night without a godly bedtime story. Children, what would you like to hear tonight?
Sleeping Beauty!
Oh, you know what the Lord calls a gal who wakes up to find a strange man kissing her on the mouth? A whore!
Cinderella!
You know what the Lord calls a gal who parties all night and returns home missing articles of clothing? A whore! And since she stayed past midnight, thereby violating the Sabbath, Cinderella was stoned to a bloody pulp by her Orthodox stepsisters.
No!
Oh, yes. But the Lord always provides a happy ending, unless he kills everyone. If only Prince Charming had raped Cinderella when she went into the woods, then he could have given her father 50 shekels to buy her in marriage. Oh, l'amour. Toujours l'amour. God is such a romantic.
But she didn't have a daddy to pay.
Okay, so the slut gets stoned to death either way.
Oh.
Another story, darlings?
Snow White!
Do you know what the Lord calls an unmarried gal who shacks up with seven male circus freaks? A whore!
Read Ezekiel 23, Mommy.
Of course, sweetie. Yet she became more and more promiscuous as she recalled the days of her youth when she was a prostitute in Egypt. There she lusted after her lovers, whose genitals were the size of donkeys and whose ejaculations were like that of horses. Children, just guess what the Lord calls such a woman.
A whore!
Now, let's pick a story not in the Bible. Enough smut for one night.
Jack and the Beanstalk.
Okay, no whores in that one. Jack planted his magical beans and was instantly stoned to death for practicing witchcraft.
But he got up the beanstalk.
Only to be stoned to death for going all Tower of Babel on the Lord and invading his personal space.
Goldilocks!
Oh, good one. Once upon a time, there was a notorious pagan called Goldilocks. Goldilocks had no Christian values, so she snuck into people's homes to soil their sheets. One night, she slipped into a shabby cluster home owned by bears. Children, recall Two Kings? Where the Lord sent 42 bears to tear 42 children to pieces simply for remarking that a bald prophet was bald. Well, guess what happened to Goldilocks when the three bears showed up at the door? Spoiler alert. She was ripped to ragged, bloody pieces for breaking and entering. Oh, shh, tears, tears, tears. That's enough of the good book for one evening. Tomorrow we'll read from Exodus, where the Lord sneaks into every house in the kingdom and murders their youngest child. That would be you, Timothy. Sweet dreams, children.
If you go down in the woods today, you're sure of a big surprise. If you go down in the woods today, you'd better go in disguise.
With a pair of scissors and a long weekend, you can turn any Bible into a book fit for a Christian home.
Stay tuned for a special tribute to Spinal Tap on its 30th anniversary and a startling revelation about its finances.
You are listening to the final edition, Radio Hour, Satire with Teeth.
And now for a special final edition Radio Hour interview. As most of our listeners probably know, this is the 30th anniversary of the release of the seminal film of our generation, or at least one very good movie, and that is This Is Spinal Tap. This Is Spinal Tap was a satire of the music industry, or perhaps it was more than that. We'll find out when we talk to Tony Hendra, who our listeners know as both the co-producer and co-star of the Final Edition Radio Hour, and as the man who played Sir Ian Faith, the band manager in Spinal Tap.
I don't think Ian has been knighted.
As just regular Ian Faith, a man who should have been knighted. Spinal Tap, to me, it was Spinal Tap, Monty Python, Holy Grail, and Animal House. Those are my three movies.
The Trinity.
Of my growing of comedy age, I guess it was. But, although Animal House always stuck in my mind more because there was a brief boob scene. But nonetheless, those are my comedy movies.
I would say that Animal House, it does fit in that, in the Trinity,
sure.
Because it is actually, it got a sort of bad rap in a way because it became seen as a gross-out movie with toga parties thrown in.
It became people think of it as the frat movie, much like they think of Calvin and Hobbes as Calvin pissing on things when it's deeper.
Exactly, yes. Its reputation was determined by its imitators.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, it was a very potent satire of further education in the United States. I mean, with the Dean Wormer, who's essentially Nixon,
mm-hmm.
who screws around with the Constitution of Faber College and the ROTC, which is essentially the military and so forth and so on. So but all of that was kind of lost under the welter of food fights and toga parties.
But no, it obviously resonated for more than just a brief boob shot with me. As did Spinal Tap. I don't think there were any boob shots. There was talk of greased up women on all fours, but
indeed,
never any shots. Spinal Tap is in a short list of movies. I won't bother pretending to remember them. That has, I think, lasted sort of the test of its time. It's been 30 years. And I think it still resonates, even with people that didn't experience sort of what it was perhaps on one level speaking to, which is sort of coming out of the 60s and into the 70s and into this the 80s looming sort of corporate era of music and everything, and making fun of those types of bands, and yet people still relate to them even if they never knew any of those elements. Why do you think that is?
Well, I think it's actually for several reasons, but one of the reasons I'd like to discuss tonight a bit is one that isn't, I don't think, talked about very much, which is that Spinal Tap is on the sort of primary level a scathingly funny parody of the fecklessness and mindlessness of heavy metal. But on a deeper level, it seems to me, it is a satire. I mean, because it's a satire, actually, of an entire system, of the lifestyle, of its assumptions, its personnel, that helped to make the likes of Spinal Tap the cultural nadir it was. Or as one NYU cultural studies course taught by a very, very serious cultural studies professor called Andrew Ross once put it, Spinal Tap and the decline of Western civilization.
Is that a cause and effect?
Well, yes, apparently, according to Andrew Ross, who is a Scot, by the way, and a very left-wing book, left-wing Scot.
Was that, maybe you're going to tell me, is that because Spinal Tap finally said the emperor has no clothes, and
everything
fell apart?
I think Spinal Tap was the meme, maybe, or the trope, or the tropey meme, or the meme
treme,
trope.
The treme.
Yeah, the treme.
The treme, that was that movie.
So, anyway, so we have the parodies, obviously wonderfully carried off by the group itself, these lampoons of heavy metal's musical subgenres with all their kind of idiotic priapism. But obviously the lampoons, the parodies are brilliant. And yeah, they're brilliant not only because of their ridiculous sexual memes, but because of their pretension. I think one of the things that Spinal Tap caught wonderfully was the pretension of heavy metal. Christopher Guest's character, Nigel Tufnell, who is basically the most moronic of the three morons who front Tap, is also its most moronically pretentious with his wonderful work in progress, his trilogy in D minor.
Yes.
Which has the working title of Lick My Love Pump.
His pretension is what led into the great, like, this one goes to 11 scene. It shattered his, he was professing such grand ambitions.
And of course, actually, Stonehenge is immensely pretentious too. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of gone down in film history as an epic stage fail, but really its lyrics and effects are just as funny, because they perfectly embody that kind of awful, flaccid, Lord of the Rings-driven, Celtic, Nordic, Aryan race memory fantasies, you know, that heavy metal loves to wallow in.
Well, it fits in also to that thing that they have earlier about having all the appealing to all the male teenagers as their audience.
Right.
I forget if that was in the scene when he had the
ocean of retarded sexuality. But the thing is that surrounding these wonderful parodies is this kind of 360-degree satire of the industry which brought us rock and fed off it, both while it was alive and well and when it was a fly-blown corpse. And basically, no rock, if you'll forgive the expression, is left unturned during Tap's pathetic journey. And all the slimy things under each one of them are given ample room to slime themselves into movie legend. You mentioned Fran Drescher, whose character name is Bobby Fleckman.
Mm-hmm.
And she has that wonderful sort of New York, whiny New York voice.
Perfect little publicist-ish type. I forget that was exactly her role. But
I mean, she's certainly a part of the slime monument that is Polymer Records. And then there's Sir Dennis Eaton Hogg, of course, who is founder of Hogwood, which is a summer camp for pale young boys. And even Howard Hessman. I don't know if Howard Hessman played the Terry Ladd.
He was the manager of the other band, right, that they came across? Is that right?
Yeah, that's right, in Memphis. And the star was Duke Fame.
Mm.
And Duke Fame had been one of the many, many members of Spinal Tap. And what was great about that scene was that Duke Fame is equally talentless. I mean, he's just as much a sort of bottom feeder as Tap is. But he happens to be on the upswing. So Howard Hessman won't let Spinal Tap touch him. And then he sort of gets out of an awkward situation.
How are you, laddie? Great to see you, Tap. Terrific to see you.
Liam.
Liam.
Ian.
Right.
Ian.
Yes.
Yeah.
But I think my favorite is Paul Schaefer's Artie Fufkin, the A&R guy in Milwaukee or wherever it is. But he shows up at the record store and eventually, having tried to blame the owner of the record store for the fact that none of the public has shown up, actually blames himself in this marvelous burst of passive aggression and says,
"I'm not asking, I'm telling with this. Kick my ass."
One of the reasons why there's never been a sequel or, in fact, an effective imitation of it is that it was very much of a certain moment. And I think everybody in the movie was sort of in some either superficial or profound way disappointed with rock and roll. And it was that moment where you still sort of could remember caring about it enough that you were actually disappointed. It's that totality of the picture, I think, that makes the movie so, so interesting. Everybody in the movie contributes to that sort of world. And in that way, I think it's a satire. I mean, I would say it's a satire comparable, at least in its scope and its success, to Dr. Strangelove, which has the same kind of, it totally creates a world where logic is absent, completely absent.
So we're talking about slime balls. And I got to say, having now worked in entertainment some, if that's what I've been doing for the last million years, is your character resonates even more because you, as the band manager, have a unique sliminess that is sort of, you sort of have to tell lies to everybody in order to keep moving forward until, like, you can no longer lie anymore. When you sort of conceptualize your character, was liar part of one of the big words that drove it, or what?
Well, no, I didn't. I mean, I didn't really think about it very much until, well, that's not quite true. I mean, I figured or modeled what I was going to do with this character on a guy called Andrew Lou Goldham. He was the manager of the Rolling Stones, and he was very much, I mean, he was sort of blonde, two-faced kind of fellow. And with a much more pucker, upper-class kind of accent than his Squatney East End of London charges.
Right. Right.
So that seemed to me to be a fairly good model. But I must say, as soon as I started improvising, I remember it exactly. It was the scene at the beginning of the movie when they're in the limousine. And Ian is lying from the first moment he opens his mouth. He says the New York Times is going to do something, and then he says, well, we're not doing anything very much in New York because it's not worth it. But Philadelphia is a big rock town. It's just right from the start, he's making excuses for things before they happen.
One of the things I always thought was interesting about Ian's character is that he, like you said, he'll say, oh, the New York Times is going to do something, and then he undercuts it. It struck me that he was the type that would always say something good, even if a second later it contradicted it. And in part, that was not just him lying, but him dealing with other characters, his charges, as you say, who are probably of the type of sociopath that only will hear the good things. That he kind of relied on being able to say, I'm going to give you $1 million. No, I'm not. And all they heard was, I'm going to give you $1 million, because want to believe the best about themselves.
Right, exactly. But one of my favorite scenes, actually, is the scene where Nigel is worried about the food. The backstage food.
Oh yeah, and
Ian is very attentive. You know, he's not lying. He's actually trying to help poor moronic Nigel fold the meat around the bread in such a way that it might be edible. But then, you know, when Nigel starts getting worked up, he says, I don't want you to ruin your performance. You know, and he means it. He means it. Nigel's all he has. You know, and he's all Nigel has. But you're right. You're right. Ian is a slime ball, and I did it brilliantly.
What do you think about Ian's role, or other people's role in the movie, as far as like sort of the corporatism of either looming corporatism of music or just in general? Because in a way, Ian, even though he's son of a slime ball, he is management. I mean, he's their manager, so he himself sort of has a corporate element.
That's what I'm saying. I think is one of the reasons it has a kind of universal appeal, and a continuing appeal, because as you say, those slime balls are still with us, and they're still screwing us, and they still run the show. And the fact is that the record company hovers sort of invisibly over the whole movie. It's not just in the occasional characters that show up from the record industry. I mean, and often Ian's job is simply to be the messenger of that. I mean, when he produces the Black Album, which doesn't even have their name on it, you know, and tries to enthuse about it. We're on our way, you know.
There is sort of this element of the corporation or the record company as God. Like, it's sort of Ian is struggling there and having to lie, but there's a sense that if the company really wanted to get behind it, they can make a star. I mean,
they could make it into Duke fame overnight if they wanted to.
Right, yeah. And yet that doesn't happen. And
I go back to this, the idea that you've just expressed, because it came out like in the height of the Reagan years, right? I mean, it came out in 1984 when sort of unchained capitalism and greed is good, was really roaring, and the corporations had. Sort of almost overnight from being the villains of the piece in the 60s and 70s were now the heroes. But I think this might be one of the reasons, if I'm right, this might be one of the reasons why, and I can reveal this now on our show.
Reveal it.
That the principles of this incredibly successful movie, I mean, one thing you can say about it is that it's not only been pretty successful all over the English-speaking world and indeed in parts of the non-English-speaking world like Germany and France, all the money that presumably has been taken in by somebody, in fact by a number of corporations, more than half a dozen actually, over the 30 years, not one cent of that has been enjoyed by the principals of the movie. No profit participation, although all of us had contracts guaranteeing profit participation. Not one cent of that has been seen. So they got their revenge. The corporation.
That's kind of amazing. And you did have contracts that said you get back. I mean, I know, look, Hollywood reporting, quote unquote, is making sure that every expense just goes in lockstep with every piece of income. But that's kind of ridiculous.
The budget for this movie?
It was what, like $12? I mean,
$4 million. Okay. Right. $4 million. It's probably one of the lowest budget, massive hit movies ever. And if there comes a point where if a movie costs $4 million and it continues to make money
for 30 years,
there's going to be some profit there somewhere.
I do have a law degree, and I'm a member of the California Bar, but I don't think I'm going to be
we ought to go on as a sort of poor little Spinal Tap, you know, and go on Kickstarter and see if we can get enough money to really slap them. That's
well, would you raise money to fund a lawsuit, or you just raise money to pay yourselves?
Because that's right. Why give it to the middleman? Yeah. Just don't call me Liam.
That was Tony Hendra who played Sir Ian. I keep saying Sir Ian. I want you to be a Sir. Ian Faith in Spinal Tap, or This Is Spinal Tap, with not just some interesting artistic and creative insights, but also a legal bombshell. That's it.
Please stay tuned for the future of vegetarianism and a new look at the story of Abraham and Isaac, soon to be a major motion picture from Darren Aronofsky.
It's time for a Not the Bible reading from Not the Bible. Today, the story of Abraham and Isaac.
And they came to the place God had told them of. And Abraham built an altar there, and placed wood thereon, and bound Isaac his son, and laid him on the wood. And Abraham stretched forth his hand, and took the knife to slay his son. And Isaac said in a mighty voice,
Father, art thou the fruit of a nut tree? Gettest thou that thing away from me?
And Abraham answered,
The Lord thy God spake unto me, Take now thine only son Isaac to the land of Moriah, and offer him there for a burnt offering on a mountain I will tell thee of. And this is that mountain.
And Isaac said,
That beeth it? The Lord thy God told thee? Wherefore didst not the Lord my God tell me? What am I, liver that hath been chopped?
And Abraham said,
Thou art my only son Isaac, whom I love. When I slay thee, the Lord God will know I fear him above all others.
And Abraham stretched forth his hand once more, and took the knife to slay Isaac. And Isaac said,
Thou callest that love? How dost thou know the voice thou hearest in thy wrinkled pate beeth the Lord thy God? For according to my mother Sarah, thou art somewhere north of 114 years old.
And Abraham said,
The Lord God hath spoken.
But Isaac wast not done.
It is something rumbling in thy ancient bowels that speaketh to thee, not the Lord God. I say unto you, father, eschew the figs and goat cheese.
But Abraham stretched forth his hand again to take the knife and slay his son Isaac, and Isaac waxed exceeding wroth.
Lay with me! Thou art one deranged old netherwind, for lo, thou canst not even tie a laying with knot.
And Isaac sprang from his bonds which he had loosed, and took Abraham, and bound him, and laid him on the wood. Then stretched he forth his hand to take the knife and slay his father. And Abraham was greatly afeared, and babbled in strange tongues. And soiled himself, and Isaac said,
Ew, father, that grosseth me out. Didst the Lord thy God make thee do that? Or wast it the figs and goat cheese?
Yet took he pity on his old father, and the two of them went down out of the land of Moriah.
For the Lord thy God's sake, leavest thy laying with loincloth here, and stayest thou upwind of me.
Then came Abraham privily to the scribes, saying,
And lo, I stretched out my hand and took the knife to slay my only son Isaac, as the Lord God instructeth me. Then the Lord God spoke to me, praising my great devotion, and released me of the burnt offering of my beloved son. And the Lord saith unto me, Thy seed shall numberless be as the stars of the heavens, because thou obeyest me.
And the scribes wrote it down whatsoever Abraham told them, that it might promote righteousness and family values. And Abraham's seed was numberless as the stars of heaven. Say that, if thou thinkest about it, it was actually the seed of his only son Isaac, especially seeing as Abraham was quite willing to have no seed at all. And believeth it or not, this infanticidal drivel beeth the bedrock of the world's three great Abrahamic religions. Here endeth the reading from Not the Bible.
For a final edition radio hour, Will Durst here to say we don't have enough stuff to worry about. Now we're running out of ways to kill people, legally. First, the maker of the go-to lethal injection drug, thiopental, stopped producing it. Then, states turned to a different drug called pentobarbital, but the Danish manufacturer didn't like being associated with executions, so they pulled the plug. Now the state's departments of killing are resorting to unreliable and possibly illegal sources, meaning we could be shooting people up with Drano-flavored Jell-O soon. You know, these punishments are being carried out on behalf of we the people, so shouldn't we the people have a say in the process? Come on, man, it's the 21st century. Why not kill the condemned creatively? Film it for pay-per-view. Make some coin on the back end. There's tons of ways to end a person's life that would be a barrel of fun at the same time and eminently watchable. For instance, imagine the hilarity to be had if a convicted man were forced to spend an entire evening in the company of Joan Rivers. Or what if they were dispatched to be Chris Christie's pedicab driver, Vladimir Putin's food taster, Barack Obama's personal pollster? Work as the only salesman at a Foot Locker during the next re-release of Air Jordan Classics. An entire season on Dancing with the Stars as Chelsea Handler's partner. Spend a day in Times Square dressed in the Disney character costume of the evil bird from Aladdin. Got three words for you people. CSI Miami Binge-a-thon. And finally, We could force the doomed to wear Google Glass into dive bars all over the Mission District of San Francisco. And the beauty of that one is, they function as their own cameraman. For the Final Edition Radio Hour, I'm Will Durst.
The Final Edition Radio Hour is performed at one time or another by Bruce Cherry, Jen Dodd, Jim Earle, Rob Gordon, Tony Hendra, Jeff Hendrick, Kevin Janis, Jeff Chrysler, Barry Lank, John Marshall, Ebby Parker, Rachel Rauch, Steve Rosenfield, Ann Tuchel, and Darby Worley. The Final Edition Radio Bruce Hour Cherry. Is written Jen, at one time or another by Bruce Cherry, Jen Dodd, Jim Earle, Rob Gordon, Tony Hendra, Jeff Hendrick, Jeff Chrysler, Barry Lank, John Marshall, Ebby Parker, and Steve Rosenfield. Miss Betty Bowers appears by permission of Devin Green and Andrew Bradley. More of her inspiring spiritual homilies can be found on YouTube at Mrs. Betty Bowers. That's MRS Betty Bowers. The Final Edition Radio Hour is produced by Tony Hendra and Jeff Chrysler. West Coast producer Barry Lank. The Final Edition Radio Hour is edited and audio produced by Greg Russ and Andrew Hammond. The Final Edition Radio Hour is the property of the Final Edition LLC, copyright 2014.